Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It is Thursday evening. This is Los Angeles LA Talk Radio, and this is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I am sitting in the studio all by myself. Can't tell you how just wonderfully this does not make me feel. The Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley, California, Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, California, and Target Freight Management in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, you know, we talk about Target Freight every show, and rightly so. They mentioned that they have a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. But have we mentioned that TFM Truckload gets your freight there every time, on time, no muss, no fuss, at the rates you need for your transportation bottom line? Call today at 844-653-7789 and tell them you heard it on The Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra for you, and some people already have. And while we're at it, if you are an LTL shipper, which is less than truckload, you are probably looking for the best rates at the lowest hassle possible. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just a ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. And right now, I'm going to bring on board our guest tonight, which is Mr. Ed Protzel, and, of course, our lovely and charming co-host, who is now sitting in Chicago, Illinois, Bobby Jean Bell. Hi, guys.
Hi, Jean.
Hey, happy to be here.
Bobby, you kind of threw me a loop this week.
I did, didn't I?
Yes, you did. But that's okay. We managed to figure it out and do what's needed to be done.
And I'm so delighted to have gotten a little bit of time away visiting with family here in the Chicago area. We had rain. Oh, my gosh. We had rain last night and thunder.
That
and
R word?
Rain all day today and rain tomorrow. And, oh, I'm loving it.
The R word. I'm gonna.
I don't know. Ed, what kind of weather have you got in St. Louis?
Oh, it's just beautiful here. 70 degrees. We have had rain a little bit, but who cares? You know?
I don't even know what that is.
I was going to say, Jim, what's your definition of rain?
70 degrees and sunny.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Which is, well, actually, it's been very cold in the morning.
Has it?
Yeah, it has. So look what you get to come home to.
I know. I'd like to stay here, actually.
So, Ed.
So, yeah. Do you want to introduce Ed?
Well, I was gonna kind of let Ed introduce himself tonight because he's got a very varied and interesting past. So, Ed, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
All right. Well, I'm from St. Louis originally, and I live here now and teach a little English, but I write full time. As I mentioned before to you when we talked, I was at one time a teenage runaway, a street person, and I lived in, when I was very young, I lived in an orphanage for a while till my father remarried. So I've had kind of a strange, odd life, and when I left home, I had $50 in my pocket and a few books, and now I'm relatively comfortable, and I write for a living, and I enjoy it a great deal. About half my life, I've been in financial services, which were worth learning, and the other half I was writing, and although it wasn't as lucrative, I would say, it really, writing is not like working to me. You know, I get up every day and that's what I want to do, and I go right for it, and I usually have something. I'm kind of an obsession writer. When I get going, that's all I want to do. And that's how I develop these wild things that I come up with.
But I will say, this one book
and
is wild.
Yeah. But I have a master's in English and a bachelor's in English, but I haven't let that stand in my way of learning anything.
Well, I mean, English degrees, you kind of have to keep learning.
Yeah. Well, it was my way of avoiding actually having to work in school.
Oh.
I could have majored in computers or something,
but that's true.
History. But that would have required a lot of hard work, and I'm just not the type, you know.
I work, but I'm almost at the end of my working career, so.
I understand.
I'm there 50 hours a week, but I don't work hard.
May I ask a question?
No. You're in Chicago. No, of course you can, Bobby.
Well, Ed, since you've shared a little bit about your past, it would sound to me from some of those experiences, you were kind of living life as an outsider. And as I think about your book that we're primarily talking about tonight, The Lies That Bind, it occurs to me that many of your characters are perhaps also outsiders. Would you say that's true?
I think that's very perceptive, Bobby. Yeah, all the characters in one way or another are outsiders, some more than others. And it's just different types and extreme types. But I'd have to say, yes, the only supportive characters are members of society, but they're still outlaws to society. I should maybe give a line or two what the book is about, and then people will know what we're talking about. Do you think I ought to do that?
Well, I think that's okay, but we don't want to get too far into it because there's a lot of spoiler alerts in this book.
Oh, yeah. We have to. Exactly.
Yeah. As long as there's one we don't violate.
Right. Well, yeah. There's a couple we won't violate.
Yeah.
So go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, give us a little synopsis.
Yeah, I'll just give you a little brief, like a log line, you call it in Los Angeles. A visionary charlatan on the run encounters a group of slaves stranded in the Mississippi wilds in 1859. Together, they agree to form an egalitarian plantation. But when the town comes around, the charlatan is the figurehead white master, and they pretend to be his slaves. Although the brains of the outfit as far as making the plantation successful is one of the slaves named Big Josh, and the charlatan's name is Dirk Hurst. Unfortunately, they collide head-on with the family that runs the town, the Frenches. That's Mrs. French and her son, Devereaux French, and they are living a lie at least as big as these Dark Horse partners. They call their plantation Dark Horse, and which, if it's uncovered, might be as fatal as if the egalitarian plantation, if Dark Horse, is uncovered.
Right.
So that's part of it. And then they adopt a child, the wealthy family, but the child dies, and then the mother shows up and looking for the child, and that's basically the foundation of the book. There's two sides. There's the Dark Horse side, that's the interlopers trying to build their own plantation out of a swamp, and then there's the wealthy people. Mrs. French is a recluse, a chess master who controls the town, and Devereaux French, who is really almost like her slave, even though he's the heir to the plantation. Devereaux is very much her prisoner, and he's so much a prisoner, in fact, that he's jealous of his own slaves. And so you asked about people being outsiders. Dirkers, the Dark Horse, whatever they call him, Dark Horse sometimes, he has always been an outsider, and he's got a piece of him that's missing. And he's never had a real long-term connection with anybody. And the book reveals his past somewhat. His father was killed by a mob, and he escaped, and he lived with the Chickasaws. The Frenches are definitely outsiders. Mrs. French is a total recluse, as I've mentioned, and doesn't like to be around anybody. And she's got the whole town terrified. She controls the bank, the gin, so forth and so on. Devereaux French has no friends. His mother manipulates him and manipulates everyone so that he won't have any close companions, that he won't have anybody that he can trust or that they can trust him. And people are terrified of befriending Devereaux, which the townspeople call him the loneliest man on earth. And he really is. And so talk about outsiders. Everyone, yes, is an outsider.
Well, his mother's also told him several times that you go against me and you'll get nothing.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Oh, she's
a piece of
work.
She's
a very interesting character. When I first met her on the written page, she reminded me a little bit of Miss Havisham from Great Expectations, although she's not anything really like her. She's not stuck in a time warp. She's not, there's not decaying bridal food, on the table in front of her. But she's this very eccentric, really, she had to be a very kind of fun character to write, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's perceptive, Bobby. I think that was part of that was an influence. Also, I believe it was the Tennessee Williams play where the father has all these expensive statues and paintings warehoused. She lives in a room that's two-thirds of it's full of very priceless valuables, and she completely ignores them. She's lost in her own head, shutting the world out, shutting her own emotions out, and
she plays chess.
She's a chess master.
Yeah. And the townspeople think she's playing chess against God.
Mm-hmm. Which,
well, actually, she's playing against Devereaux.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Hey, while we got you here, Ed, why don't you kind of let's talk about some of the stereotypes that was found in traditional Southern historic literature, because, I think that you've kind of blown a lot of them apart. So why don't you kind of just go through that a little bit, if you wouldn't mind?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's a really important part of the book. The traditional Southern depiction of slaves, there's a great book on this called The Slave Community and Life in the Antebellum South, is the slow-witted or the happy and this and that. The South was always promoting those ideas so that people would be in the North would be prone to not be active against the slave and the racial situation in the South. Well, the way I changed that, naturally, first of all, in the Dark Horse Plantation, the partnership, Big Josh runs the plantation, so immediately I turned that upside down, that the real intelligence and power and the heart and soul of the group is a black man. And then Isaac, another character, there's really a triad of the three characters in the plantation, and there's a lot of triangles of characters in the book structurally. The third one is Isaac, who was what in history is known as a maroon. There were a number of slaves that escaped, and they were living in the wilds, and they were called maroons. Now, when I wrote this, originally this was based on a screenplay I wrote, I didn't know till I did later research that there were slaves who ran plantations for dissolute masters. You don't see that in the books. Also, there were, I kind of invented, how can we make this guy as a writer, how can I make this guy different? And he'd been mistreated so badly that he's angry all the time. And so when those three get together, and they're together when we're in a scene at the Dark Horse plantation site, there's always conflict. You'll notice on in every scene there's conflict between two or three people. And Isaac was so badly treated and has so much anger, and he is actually more alien to society than anyone. Dirk Hirsch said, oh, you know, he thinks this guy's more like me than any of the others because I've been an outsider my whole life. This guy's as much of an outsider as I am. But Isaac has so much anger inside him and so much resentment that what everybody's thinking, he says. So every time Hirsch tries to pull one of his schemes or whatever, and it runs contrary to the safety of their plantation, Isaac's the first one to tear into him. He's a charlatan. He's a liar, et cetera, et cetera. And while that these two are in conflict all the time, and that stirs up all the scenes, in a way, as Bobby said, they're both outsiders and they're both alike. They're just two ends of the same coin. And originally, when these people meet in the swamp, they're terrified of each other. First of all, there are a dozen of these stranded slaves, scared to death, don't know what to do. Their master's been murdered by a mad Chickasaw chief. If Dirk turns them in for a reward, how did they explain their master being murdered? And Dirk is terrified because he's kind of surrounded. They've got their tools in their hands. If they get to be too afraid of having him around, he's dead. So it starts off with anger and distrust and disbelief, and they come up with this magical idea of we're going to build this plantation together. And throughout the whole book, they have to learn to trust themselves and each other. And especially with Dirk coming up with these ideas that could make them rich, but could get them killed, could get them hung, could get them run off. It's an iffy situation.
Well, it's like Big Josh told Dirk that, you know, this what we're doing. You know, if we get caught, we'll only get beat. You'll get hung.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. Yeah. So it's a risky situation for them.
So you did bring this off of a screenplay, which is amazing. Normally it's the other way around.
Yeah, well, I was writing screenplays. I wrote a number of screenplays. Lived in Los Angeles a little while, and I tell you, this story just really grabbed me, and there was so much meat there, and such a good idea. As you know, it wasn't just the slave relationship, but every relationship was kind of turned inside out. And everything that happened, I was able to make ironic, humorous, sad. I mean, these characters are emotionally kind of stressed out. They're at their limits. Mm. And when they run into each other quite a bit. And as things happen, periodically different ones fall into total despair. Josh at one time said, he says, oh, he just wants to burn the mansion down. They build a mansion. He says, which the slaves live in it. And along with Dirk, but they're not slaves anymore, kind of. Technically, legally, it's edgy because he signed their manumission papers. Of course, he didn't really own them,
right.
So they could be considered free in some way or not. But Josh says, you know, just when he discovers the war started, and Antoinette, the woman from New Orleans, had warned him that this war is coming, and she's very Cassandra-like. This war is coming, and it's going to bring down all these plantations, and it's going to bring the land to utter waste and ruin and cover it in blood. He sees this coming true, and he says he just wants to burn down the mansion, go drown himself in the river. It's the death of hope, and so the people in this book are always fighting for hope, and it's so just out of their grasp.
Right.
And
right.
Just like for many of us today.
Yeah, there's actually,
you
could draw a pretty nice parallel there.
right. There's a character that I particularly like, and she's charming. She's young. She's not in a lot of scenes. You introduce the concept of the honor store, and being a retailer at heart, of course, my eyes and my ears picked up, and I wanted to understand the concept of the honor store. And Ellen, tell us a little bit about the runnings of the honor store and share a little bit about Ellen, if you might.
Okay. And if you wanted to, I could read sections. But anyway, the honor store is not very based in practicality, and its survival is very tenuous, to say the least.
But that's retailing.
The honor store, the grandfather's a senior deacon, and his granddaughter lives with him. She's very naive. She lives in the honor store, and she goes to church, and that's all she knows. She's an outsider as well. The young people don't have much to do with her. And the honor store is the grandfather sits all day in a rocking chair reading the Bible, and it's the old one with the vain, vindictive, violent God. It's not any of that new stuff. Mm. And when people come in, if they don't have money to buy something, they can take it. And he writes what they wrote, what they took on a piece of paper, and puts it in the box. And assuming that if times get better, they'll pay, which both sides know won't happen. It makes them feel better doing this. And at the end of the day, he gets up and he goes to where Ellen's cooking dinner and pours the pieces of paper into the fire, and he lets God be the accountant for the honor store. And what he's looking for a throne in heaven, and this is going to get him, this is going to build him a large credit balance in heaven. And but the eating is not always very dependable with those two. anyway, go ahead.
Tell us about, Ellen makes a little pin money on this. Sort of on the side. What does she do to help bring a little income in?
Yeah, she gets a little income by doing certain minor records of the town, and stuff that's too unimportant to send to the county seat. And so one thing she can do, she has manumission papers to free slaves, but no one's ever asked for them. So she gets the notion, when she meets this dark horse, she signs the manumission papers freeing his partner, supposedly, and she just goes through a whole emotional thing. She lets him see her in a secret dress she made, which her grandfather, she keeps hidden in a ship robe. She calls little down, and she actually even kissed him once, and she'd never kissed anybody. And when he leaves, she is just trembling and crying. She's ruined the honor store, and she's dishonest. And then she gets a vision that she is going to be she is being guided by God to free all the slaves in town, most of which, or almost all of which, are owned by the French family. So. Mm-hmm. Ellen only appears about four times in the novel, but she really brackets it. She was an invention of the novel. She really didn't even have any lines in the screenplay. But when I started writing about the honor store and her, it just came, and it's funny and it's ironic and it's sad. And
kind of an innocent that is quite protected. She doesn't really know a lot of the ways of the world, per se. She kind of was pure hope. She got so excited about this opportunity that she could have to this, potentially to be involved in freeing of slaves for her, that's a, you know, that's her moment in history. And it's so great the way you write about how she has the paper and she counts out how many, and oh, she has enough. There's 12, I think, and she has enough of this, you know, particular document. And I found her, of all the characters, when Ellen enters the scene, it's kind of a little like, oh, I can sort of take a little breath and I can rest here a moment and read about Ellen, because you really have us. You really have us on the move, you know. We're using our brains. We're trying to figure out the twists and the turns, and we're gasping and we're laughing and we're like, what? You know, what? I have to read that paragraph again because I, you know.
Exactly. It's like in a tragedy. Then they'll have a comic scene like Shakespeare every once in a while. In a tragedy, he'll have a kind of a comic scene. And she's like that, kind of an emotional release thing. And they were, oh, well, this, her thought, you know, and her idea that she's going to free all the slaves is seems so impractical and impossible, but, you know, who knows?
Well, it got started. I mean, you started there. Tell me a little bit about the research. You bring in some interesting. We talk about cotton markets. We talk about future, you know, buying futures. Kind of get into all of that. You set it in 1859. You know this territory. You give us a map. So fun in the beginning of the front of the book. Tell us a little bit about your research process. Jim and I always love to talk a little bit about process. And maybe, Jim, do we want to move into process now?
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask about one thing before we got into that.
Oh, of course.
Talk a little bit about your egalitarian plantation, because I'm sure a lot of people out there don't know what that is.
Oh, okay. In other words, they're partners, and they're all equal. And so one person is not the boss. Very good point. One person is not the boss, and the others are subservient to them. They all kind of do everything by consensus. It's almost like some Native American tribes. So Dirk is not anybody's boss. He's got the Big Josh is a de facto boss just because of his confidence. And his strong spirit and his strong mind, everybody leans on him. And actually, Dirk Hurst, the figurehead, quote, white master, actually comes to see him as a big brother. And they learn to trust each other as time goes on. So that's a good point. This is a really... Not a structured society. Like the society they're in is very caste. You know, it's got rich people, poor people, slaves. Mm-hmm. Okay, what it's whose ideas matter, and really I didn't talk much about this, but. There's really a mythology there, and I've kind of stolen a little mythology. Mm-hmm. It's almost an American mythology. They leave a structured society. Europe was a very structured society with nobility and so forth. And here they're in the wilds building their own civilization in defiance of the old ideas. So you might notice the first section's called Elysian Scrubland. Elysian Fields is the Greek heaven.
Right.
Well, this is Elysian Scrubland. This is America, you know. and the county seat is called Lethe Creek. Well, the river Lethe is the underground where dead people went, you know. So, but anyway, the whole thing is I've also created a mythology. So, that there is what we are as a country, people from different backgrounds trying to find their way and find something that works. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're still trying to do, I guess.
I guess. Well, you know, that your title is certainly germane to this book, because I don't think anyone in this book is capable of telling a truth.
That is
true. That's a liar. They won't survive.
Oh my God!
They're all lying to survive.
Everything out of their mouth is a lie. Well,
you know,
especially the French family.
I needed to reread it and then make a little, you know, a little mark, a little keep count of like lie.
Hey,
see how many lies there are.
Within their little group, they tell the truth. Within the partnership. You know, the Dark Horse Plantation, they tell the truth. The mother and daughter, the mother lies. The daughter's just trying to figure out, Devereaux, the son, tries to figure out what's a lie and how is Mrs. French trying to control him.
Right, so, but he knows the big lie.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about process, and let's start okay. the process conversation with how do you do your research, and what did you do to research this particular screenplay / book?
Okay. Actually, the original idea I got from this, I'm a huge Faulkner fan. I've read everything of Faulkner's a number of times. And I was reading Absalom, which many people consider the best American novel of all time. It's up there with Huck Finn, you know. But it's quite different.
Mm-hmm.
In Absalom, Thomas Sutpen is the epitome, emblematic of the South. You know, he comes and he steals all this land, and he builds this plantation and all this stuff. And but they never mention his slaves in it. You know, there's a slight reference to the slaves, but he is the big man. He is this. He is that. And so I said, wait a minute. I mean, didn't his slaves do most of his work? And what if the slaves were the brains of the outfit? And so forth. So I took that and turned it inside out, and that's where I have an equal partnership. An egalitarian plantation. That's where I got the idea. And the mind that rose to the top was Big Josh, because he'd run a plantation for his former dissolute master, made people call him the general, although he'd never had a military career. So the same on the other side. I read that. I've been a tremendous reader of the Civil War, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's just after years of reading and interest, this whole idea of this story came to me because it turned everything I'd read inside out and created situations that were funny, ironic, tragic. In fact, it was a tragic situation, and it revealed themes. I don't have to express themes about this book. The book reveals its own themes that the reader gets, racial themes, sexual themes, and so forth. And so mm-hmm. It's all there. When you're done, you know, I think that's the advantage of reading Faulkner. It may be a pain to read, but when you're done, you're satisfied. Well, this, I tried to make it easy reading Faulkner, you know, just conflict in every scene, mm-hmm. No long-winded descriptions. The writing is all impressionistic as far as descriptions and so forth, just to give you a sense of where they are and what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. Now, you mentioned the cotton markets. When I started in financial services when I was very young and very poor, got me into it, I was a commodity futures broker. So I actually went to work for a firm that eventually I was the whistleblower at the firm, and the owner eventually became a felon. But I did learn the cotton futures brokerage business. I was had a broker's license. And actually, when I started writing this book, especially with process, a screenwriter I knew when I was in Los Angeles named Casey said, you know, always heighten the conflict. And you'll notice in my book, every scene, there is conflict. And except, you know, Ellen, when she goes off into her flights of trying to decipher how God wants her to behave and so forth. She's really sweet. People love her. You're not the only person, Bobby. I love her, too. And she just came up one day. I just wanted to describe the honor store. And I described the honor store, and that was crazy. And then I got into Ellen, and that was crazy. And I said, boy, this is really fun. And had a little, and it sort of released some of the tension that had built up.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, the cotton market, I had read years ago, and I can't remember what book it was in, some history on the antebellum South and the beginning of the Civil War, which this is 1859 to 61, so the war started when the book's over. I had read that the cotton markets had gone up the first previous years because people up north and in Europe were laying in cotton because they felt the war was going to come. They wanted to make sure they had a supply of cotton for their mills when the war came. So that's, you'll notice the French families made a lot of money the last few years trading cotton.
Right.
And so Dirk's going to trade cotton futures, and French, to oppose Dirk, is trading the opposite sides of his transactions. So one of them's going to destroy the other by economic means rather than violence. So, you have to read in the book, but there are twists in the cotton market when the Civil War starts.
Right.
For example, the president, Jefferson Davis of the South, didn't want any cotton to be shipped to the northern mills because a lot of the powerful politicians and generals from the north owned mills. So they wanted them to go broke so they couldn't fight the South anymore. So he had cotton burned, southern cotton burned on the docks so that they couldn't be shipped to the north. Well, if you can't ship something somewhere, what happens to the value of it?
No, it takes
it's been going up for 3 years in a row, and now it collapses because there's nowhere to ship it anywhere,
sure.
And nobody will pay for something they can't get. So that was one of the elements. There's a scene in there I know you'd like, and it was another kind of a whiz-off scene that turns out to be hilarious. Do you remember how he got the idea to start trading cotton futures? The old house slave they had said, "Oh, you got to have a bunion." Who tells him about how the master used to trade cotton?
Yes, yes, and the weather. Yes,
he says, "A bunion? What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, that's how General get his money. So and so worked in the kitchen, had a bunion, but he got sick, he died. Missus started crying. The general lose a plantation. Here we is in a swamp." Straightening that out for the for Dirk Hurst and all the other partners and the reader is a whole funny tangled thing because old Moses kind of sees things from his own point of view. He held the master's liquor cabinet key, so he saw things in kind of a different way, you know, and still
yeah.
does.
Bobby,
yeah, in the South, the field slaves looked down on the house slaves, and the house slaves looked down on the field slaves, and both of them looked down on the very poor whites who lived even more poor than they did, mm-hmm. which is saying quite a bit. And the whites, of course, looked down upon the slaves, so it was a mutually hostile situation all around. And I think I've put people in that situation here and kind of just illustrated it a little bit.
Hey,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
We're kind of be running out of time here pretty quick, so there's some stuff I want to get to. This is Bobby. Did you want to ask him the question?
No, go ahead.
Well, the name of the show is The Writer's Block, so we ask all of the writers that are on board with us, have you ever gotten writer's block?
Well, I'll tell you, I would say no up till about this week. And I'm, honestly, I've never really had it too much. I've gone through strains, period. What am I going to do? I just finished a novel called The Antiquities Dealer, and there was a period where, what am I going to do to finish it? Really, what I've been doing is I've been thinking of the concept that gets me excited, and then I think of the ending, which gets me excited. You mentioned you liked the end of Lies That Bind.
Yes, I did.
Jim, yeah. Imagine that on film, if they'd have made a film of that.
I think everybody would be thoroughly confused if they made a film out of it.
But I kind of have this week, because I haven't thought of the end of my book, but I've already got 4 chapters written and about 3 or 4 chapters sketched out. So it's not really totally writer's block. It's just I get emotionally tied up, and then I break through and come up with a concept that I've really got to go after. This new book, Antiquities Dealer, the last quarter of the book, I just had no idea this stuff was going to happen. And I think it's a pretty amazing book. And the ending of it, who done it, you might say, is really someone who, in the beginning, I didn't even think was going to be the guiltiest person. There's a lot of guilty people. As you can imagine, it's got a lot of guilty people in it.
Well, especially dealing with antiquities.
The guiltiest person is someone that will surprise you a bit.
So talk a little bit about your process, your writing process. Our listeners like to hear that from our writers, because it gives them an idea of where to go with theirs.
All right. First off, I come up with a concept that really excites me, and it has to be something that sparks a lot of ideas. Releases a lot of possibilities, like this idea from The Lies That Bind. It creates a lot of different possible conflicts, would release a bunch of issues. Also, my concept would involve major important themes and social ideas. Then think of an ending, so no matter which way I go, the story will eventually bend towards that ending, which can get adjusted a little bit. Then I come up with characters. Now, in Lies That Bind, you'll notice almost all these characters, not only do they have conflicts between each other, but the major characters have conflicts within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not under all this pressure. Not only are they having to deal with external pressures, but, you know, they might crack. In fact, Lies That Bind is the first of a trilogy. In the second book, a couple of the characters have cracked after the first book, and they're way off on a limb somewhere. But in Lies That Bind, in trying to hold on to something in that missing part of them, are the hope that's in there, even though they're hollow and they're empty and they're sad and they're in despairing, they have this internal conflict. Like Mrs. French wants to get Devereaux to kill Dirk Hurst and steal all that land.
Right.
That Dirk Hurst is a threat to them. Well, the reader will find out about it, but Devereaux French has an absolute conflict not wanting to kill Dirk, and the pressure on Devereaux becomes unbearable. Devereaux starts acting irrationally. Dirk Hurst has conflicts. When Devereaux offs him money for the land he stole from the Chickasaws, he thinks about taking it. You know, mm-hmm. He thinks about just grabbing the money and run, but then he realizes, oh, my partner's here. I've promised these people that we're going to do this together, and I can't break their word. Mm-hmm. Another thing is Dirk is not brave. He's a coward. He's lived his life just escaping all the wolves of the world, trying to do his hustles, trying to do his scams, but also just barely getting by. You know, he started when he was 10 years old. A mob was going to kill him. Mm-hmm. And so the further he gets into it, the more committed he becomes, and he's never been a committed person, the more terrified he becomes. So he has that conflict building up. As things progress, he gets scarier.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see triangles in it. When you read it, you'll see that, et cetera, et cetera.
What are you reading right now?
Pardon?
What are you reading right now?
Oh, I'm reading a book on the history on the Medici family. The Rise and Fall. It's an old book I bought in a used bookshop. I read a lot of history, and I love it. And my new book starts off with a sentence, the follow-up to Lies of Bind, says, "History is far, far stranger than fiction." He says, however, if you consider the people, the characters real people, with hatreds and fears and desires like us, then everything they do makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
You know, we try to see historical figures fitting some idea we have, but they're not chess pieces. They were people. They were doing stuff for reasons that they...
Ed, you have a lot of dialogue in the book. Is writing dialogue come easily to you, or... You know, tell us a little bit about
I think we lost him, Bobby. Let me redial him.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you didn't do it. I don't know. All of a sudden, he was gone.
Oh.
I know, huh?
Oh.
Hello, I hit the button and disconnected.
So you are the culprit.
Talking with my hands with the phone in my ear.
Well, we need to kind of move this along. We're running out of time. So, Bobby, you got the question.
This is a very, you have to answer this one quickly because we are running out of time, but you have a lot of wonderful dialogue in this book. Tell us a little bit about how you go about writing dialogue.
All right. Well, you know, this was written as a screenplay, and I think that dialogue's my forte. But I just, I get in all the characters' heads, and as I was going to say about the process, I sort of build the characters and let them carry the story. Mm-hmm. I go where they want to go, and they say what they want to say, and they do what they want to do. And I think that's the answer, but I think over what's going to happen a lot in a scene, and I think of the people saying what means the most to them in the most clever way they can say it. Not mm-hmm. necessarily clever, but the most direct way they can say it. And
do you read it out loud to yourself to see if it sounds, you know, like it's natural?
Oh yeah, I do. Sure, I do. Very much so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
Where have you heard that before, Bobby?
I'm sorry.
Where have you heard that before?
We've heard that from a few people,
myself included.
And we've heard no, I don't.
Yeah.
And do you write longhand? You know, on yellow tablets, or are you on a computer?
I'm on a computer. Lets me cut things out, move them around. I write on a computer.
Good
and
man.
I've been doing it so long, it's just I kind of have the idea and it shows up on the paper.
There you go.
Except I'm not that great a typist.
I don't think any of us are. Hey, Ed, we're going to have to let you go. I've got, can you give our listeners your email information and your website? Because I personally got on your website and spent about a couple hours there the other day.
Oh, yeah, and okay. I was following all kinds of places and stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's www.edprotzel. The Protzel is like pretzel with an O, P-R-O-T-Z-E-L, .com. So www.edprotzel.com. And how to contact me is on my website. Stuff about other screenplays I have or books that are in progress are all out there. How to contact me is out there. How to get, pardon? Oh, and where you can buy the book, of course, you can get it on Amazon and all those places. But
you have a couple book signings coming up that I saw, so check out his website. If you live locally, go support those booksellers that
Absolutely.
Are selling his books.
And look, Ed, feel free anytime you want to call in on the show. If you're welcome to.
Oh, I will, because you have a wonderful show. You have terrific writers on there, and it's fascinating to hear how their minds work.
Well, thank you. It's nice to hear.
And post on Facebook. Whenever you're posting something on your Facebook page, please come on and bring it on over to the Writer's Block Facebook page. We'd really appreciate that.
That, and I'm sending you a mug tomorrow.
Yeah, also, you know, I have a Facebook page and all that, and you can get on my list. I'll send you emails when news comes out or if I do a blog or something like that.
Perfect.
And, so www.edprotzel.com, B-R-O-T-Z-E-L.
Perfect. Thanks so much for joining us tonight, Ed. It's been a hoot.
Thank you, Ed.
Well, thanks for having me. It has been a hoot.
It has been a hoot.
Enjoyed it.
And Jeannie, if you're out there listening, we got another one. All right. Take care, Ed. We'll be talking soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ed Protzel. Are you there?
Well, that was fun.
It was fun. And this is your first long-distance co-hosting.
It was. I hope I sounded okay.
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
Yeah, you sounded just fine.
Oh,
you came through loud and clear. How was your concert last week?
Oh, it was fantastic.
Yeah?
Yes. Mike Beck was great. If we weren't already booked with all of our guests to the end of the year, I'd say we need to book him to talk about songwriting.
Well, we have...
It was a wonderful concert.
I think we have two spaces left in December.
Well, maybe we should do that. Tell a bookie not to book them. Leave them open.
Well, she's still being inundated by people wanting to be on the show.
Yeah, I understand that. Isn't that a thrill? How special is that?
Yep. And if you're listening to us tonight and you are part of the writer, are you part of the writing team that's going to be at the Buckaroo Bookstore, feel free to call in on the show and kind of give us a little idea of what you're going to be doing while you're there. I believe we talked about that.
We did.
And we got to hurry along. So, Bobby, I will see you next week in studio.
We'll see you next week from tonight.
Unless
on the writer's block.
Unless I get another email saying you're going to Maine. Take care, Bobby.
Hey, I showed up. You have a good night,
you
Jim.
Do. Okay, good night. Take care. Bye-bye. And Bobby Jean on the phone, and considering this is Thursday, it's now the end of this Thursday show, and we'll be with you again next week at 8 o'clock on LA Talk Radio, The Writer's Block, and we are out of here.